All right, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning service coming to you live from St. Francisville, Louisiana. It's good to be here with you today. Thanks for joining us on this glorious Shabbat. This week, I want to continue in our present study. We'll continue in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, in the wilderness. Last week, we covered the Torah portion, Balak. This week, we're in Pinchas, and I just can't get out of the wilderness. So over the last several weeks since I've returned from Israel, I've been studying various things, and it just so happens that this particular Torah portion plays into something that I'm working on in relation to my book and so forth, so it just worked out perfectly. So we are in the book of Bamidbar. Last week's class, if you recall, was called Balaam's Book, The Pagan Prophecies. And I talked about various things. I talked about these incredible words that come to us from a non-Israelite prophet, a seer, and how some of these words have made it all the way into the liturgy every week in the synagogue. So it's quite an interesting story. If you missed last week's teaching, you can go back and get that on Facebook and YouTube, as you all know. If one only read the words of Balaam recorded in Balaam's book, in Sefer Bilam, Numbers chapter 22 through 24, as I mentioned last week, if you only read those words, you would likely come away with a pretty positive or favorable opinion of Balaam. But I mentioned last week that there's more to the story, and over the next couple of weeks, if you're following the annual cycle of Torah reading, you will see what I'm talking about. Most of you already know this, of course. But I wanted to start off today's teaching with a passage that comes from last week's Haftarah from Micah chapter 6, in Micah chapter 6. So let's start today in Micah 6 and verse 5, in Micah 6 verse 5. And I just want to pick this up again. Let's see. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, devised and what Bilam, the son of Beor, answered him. From Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of Jehovah. Now, one of the things that I pointed out last week is that in this particular passage, Tzidkot Yehovah, Tzidkot is the plural form of righteousness. So I made this plural, and obviously one of the listeners said, please follow the grammatical standards. This is not proper. It shouldn't be said righteousnesses. I hope most of you understand that that was a teaching point. I wanted to illustrate that in the Hebrew, that the righteousness of Jehovah here and in several other places is presented in the plural. That's why this English translation says the righteous acts of Jehovah. But the idea is that somewhere, if you're studying this particular leg of the journey, this particular last phase, if you will, of the 40-year wilderness journey, the children of Israel are at the last stage of that journey. They are on the east side of the Jordan, in the plains of Moab, a place called Shittim. All right, Shittim, as I talked about last week, Shittai is the word that's used for acacia. So this particular leg of the journey from Shittim to Gilgal is the last, it represents the last stop outside the land. And Gilgal is the first stop on the inside of the land, once they cross over the Jordan. Now, a great deal happens in a short period of time in a not-so-great distance. And that's the point. It's that between Shittim and Gilgal, both in space and time, a lot goes on, a whole lot. And one of the things that I want to focus on today is referred to by the biblical writers as the matter, this is English translation, the matter of Peor. The matter of Peor. It's specifically called out as a great and grievous sin. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about, if you remember the title for today's class that I posted, is Zeal, and the Roots of Righteousness. So we're talking about there's a great and grievous sin, but there's also a manifestation of something quite positive and good that I want to focus on. So I'm going to focus on the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you will, from Shittim to Gilgal. We're still in that phase of the journey, both in time and in location. I want to begin today in this particular class in the book of Numbers, chapter 25, Bamidbar, chapter 25. And if you'll go with me there to the first verse, 25, beginning in verse 1, it says, "And Israel abode in Shittim." Now, this is actually from the reading last week, but it sets the context. "Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people to the sacrifices of their gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself to Baal Peor. And the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel. And Jehovah said to Moses, 'Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them up before Jehovah against the sun, that the burning anger of Jehovah may be turned away from Israel.' And Moses said to the judges of Israel, 'Slay every one his men that have attached themselves to Baal Peor.'" And the story gets even worse. There is a specific incident that is mentioned where one Israelite man takes one of these women and commits a very bad act with the woman, apparently, in the sacred precinct. And one named Pinchas stands up and stays a subsequent plague. Now listen, in this particular story in the book of Bamidbar, in chapter 25, verses 1 and following, it says that the people of Israel prostituted themselves with the daughters of Moab. They were offering sacrifices to the gods of these other people. This is a horrible, horrible story. The children of Israel have been through a great deal leading them up to this point. And you would think that by now they had worked out all the bad within themselves and begun to prepare for the entry into the glorious promised land that God had been promising to his people from the very beginning of the patriarchal narratives. But it says specifically that Israel yoked himself to Baal Peor. Now, Baal, as you know, is the name of, it's generally assigned to a Canaanite god. Baal, it's sometimes translated as Lord, but Baal, Lord or Master of Peor, is evidently this particular god to which they yoke themselves. So the matter of Peor, when we read the matter of Peor, it can be translated the word, the matter, the thing. So it's this thing of Peor that they attach themselves to. But it's associated with all sorts of licentious behavior. It's just bad. I mean, from harlotry in a physical sense to adultery in a spiritual sense, they have become one with another god. And this is one of the greatest crimes that is outlined in the biblical text from the beginning up until the very end. They're walking after the other gods. They're sacrificing to these gods. And what this leads to is a great and devastating plague, a striking, which takes the life, according to the text, of 24,000 people of God. Now, if you were to move forward in the story, even beyond this week's Torah portion, and I just want to pick up one verse from Numbers chapter 31, because last week there were a couple of questions. Look, I agree, and I've made it clear that if you only read Balaam's words, you would come away with a very positive impression of Balaam. But according to Numbers chapter 31, verse 16, it says, "Behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to revolt against Jehovah in the matter of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of Jehovah." All devar Peor, according to the matter of Peor. Balaam advises these other rulers of a way that they can penetrate the people of Israel's security, if you will. We already know that Balaam recognized that because Jehovah was standing on behalf of the children of Israel, that he could say nothing unless Jehovah would put it in his mouth. But there was another way. The other way would be to present before the children of Israel an enticement to encourage them to go into all sorts of bad behavior, and it worked. It worked to a certain degree. Now, as I mentioned, one man, a man by the name of Pinchas, a priest, descendant of Levi, stands up and takes charge of the situation and stays the plague. And we're going to talk a little bit about what makes Pinchas a hero of the faith, if you will. And it ties to my title related to the word zeal, as it's often translated in the Hebrew Bible. Kana is actually the word. We're going to get into this a little bit. But before I do, I want to look a little bit more about Pinchas and something which happens years later. And we'll come back and circle back around. So if you go with me to the book of Joshua, to the book of Joshua, chapter 22. Now, I typically don't like to read long sections of text, but I think in this case I need to, because I want to illustrate something that's very important and ties in with the teaching today. Now, according to the chronology of things, if you were reading your Bible, when you get to Joshua chapter 22, you need to understand that the tribal allotments have been made, okay? The Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have kept their word to Moses. Remember, they request, "Let us stay on the east side of the Jordan," and the deal that is worked out between Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh is, we'll go over across, we'll leave our women and so forth, but we'll go over and we'll help settle the land. We'll help you battle the inhabitants of the land. And once you're securely in place and the allotments have been made, then we'll go back. And it was agreeable. Everyone agreed to the terms of this. And so this has already taken place. So now we get to Joshua chapter 22, and I want to pick up at verse 9. And the children of Reuven, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel out of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the country of Gilead, to the land of their possession, of which they were possessed, according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And when they came to the districts of the Jordan that are in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, a great and conspicuous altar. And the children of Israel heard say, "Behold, the children of Reuven, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar over against the land of Canaan in the districts of the Jordan on the side of the children of Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go up to war against him." So word reaches back to the children of Israel. Remember, at Shiloh is where Joshua begins to distribute the land. It's the first area that the children of Israel really plant sort of a stronghold in the land. And it's there that for 369 years, the tabernacle and the headquarters, if you will, is stationed. And so word reaches the children of Israel that Reuven, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar outside of the holy precinct. And so they have this meeting. They're going to go to war against their brothers because they feel that they have violated the sacred order. Now, look at verse 13. "And the children of Israel sent to the children of Reuven, to the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, into the land of Gilead, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and with him 10 princes of each chief house, a prince throughout all the tribes of Israel, and each one a head man of the house of their fathers among the thousands of Israel. And they came to the children of Reuven, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, to the land of Gilead, and they spoke with them, saying, 'Thus says the whole congregation of Jehovah, what trespass is this that you've committed against the God of Israel to turn away this day from following Jehovah by building for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against Jehovah?' Now get this. Is the iniquity of Peor too little for us, from which we have not been cleansed unto this day?" Now remember, this is after the conquest of the land. "Although there was a plague in the congregation of Jehovah, but that you must turn away this day from following Jehovah. And it will be, if you rebel today against the Jehovah, that tomorrow he'll be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Howbeit, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass over to the land of the possession of Jehovah, where Jehovah's tabernacle dwells, and take possession among us. But rebel not against Jehovah, nor rebel against us in building an altar for yourselves, because the altar of Jehovah our God, did not Achan, the son of Zerah, commit a trespass in regard to devoted property, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel, and that man perished not alone in his iniquity." Their point is, look, a couple of things bother us about what you're doing. Your sin is going to bring catastrophe on all of us. And they give an example. Remember when Achan takes this devoted property that he wasn't supposed to take and how that affected us? Look, your crime has implications for the whole body of Israel. Now, leading this charge is the zealot Pinchas. He's right in the middle of this. Now, look at verse 21. "Then the children of Reuven, the children of Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said to the heads of the thousands of Israel, 'The mighty one, God Jehovah, the mighty one, God Jehovah, he knows and Israel shall know if in rebellion or if in transgression against Jehovah, save thou us not this day. If we built an altar for ourselves to turn from following Jehovah, or if to offer a burnt offering or a meal offering upon it, or if to offer peace offerings upon it, let Jehovah himself demand reparation. Or if we've not rather done this out of anxiety, saying, in time to come, your children might speak to our children, saying, what have you to do with Jehovah, the God of Israel? For Jehovah has made the Jordan a border between us and you. You, children of Reuben, children of Gad, you have no part in Jehovah. So shall your children make our children cease fearing Jehovah. Therefore, we said, and what they're saying is, if it's not obvious, we didn't do, if we did this in wrongful intent, then let God take action. Or if we did it thinking that one day our descendants would feel separated from you, and so we're creating an alternate worship site, he's saying we're not doing any of that. Now look at this, verse 24. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, that it may be a witness between us and you and our generation after us, that we might do the service of Jehovah before him with our burnt offerings and with our sacrifices and with our peace offerings, that your children might not say to our children in time to come. And it goes on. Now go down to verse 28. Behold, the pattern of the altar of Jehovah, which our fathers made, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifices. This is just a witness between us and you. And they go on and they say, look, we have built an altar. Indeed, we did it after the pattern, but it is a witness and it has nothing to do. We're not offering sacrifice on this particular altar. Now, I want to read just a little bit more. If you go down to verse 30, and Pinchas, the priest and the princes of the congregation, the heads of thousands of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the children of Reuben, children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh spoke. It pleased them. So they're satisfied. And Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the children of Reuben, children of Gad, and to the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that Jehovah is among us, because you've not committed a trespass against Jehovah. Now you've delivered the children of Israel out of the hands of Jehovah. And Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the princes returned from the children of Reuben, and so forth and so on. Verse 33, and the thing pleased the children of Israel. The children of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of going up against them in battle to destroy the land wherein the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. And the children of Reuben, the children of Gad called the altar Ed, for it shall be a witness between us that Jehovah is God. Now, I know that was a lot of reading, but I wanted to cover something because two things stand up and stand out in the text. The first is that an altar need not be an altar upon which burnt offering and sacrifices is offered. Now, the assumption is, and this remains the case to this day, I'm not going to go far into my point here because it's for something else I'm working on, but an altar biblically does not necessarily mean a place of slaughter. All right, and this particular text, generally the word that's translated from the Hebrew into English as altar is mizbeach, and zevach generally means to slaughter. So here we have a place of slaughter upon which no slaughter is performed. It's for a witness, and it represents dedication to Jehovah without bloodshed. Now, the second thing, and perhaps more importantly in context of what I want to cover today, is that the assumption was that the children of Israel were in rebellion, and that when they thought of themselves in that rebellious place, they made this comment, is not the matter of Bel of Peor bad enough? In other words, they said, we're not cleansed from that iniquity to this day. So from the time that the incident at Baal Peor takes place, going all the way through the conquest of the land, and they at least believe that this matter of Peor has not been cleansed. Now, part of the thing that I want to think about today is a question. And the question is simply a question. It's not a dogmatic statement of belief, so keep this in your mind as I say it. Has the matter of Peor been cleansed at this time? Has it truly been cleansed at this time? Now, keep that in mind. I want you to go with me to the book of Hosea the prophet, and I want you to go to chapter 9, Hosea chapter 9. In Hosea chapter 9, Hosea is a prophet to the northern kingdom of Israel, to Ephraim, the 10-tribe kingdom, which ultimately were scattered throughout all the ends of the earth. Now remember, Judah is exiled from the land following the destruction by the Babylonians in 586 BCE. Some say 587, I go with 586. But in 586, when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem, they took the kingdom of Judah, the southern tribes, if you will, and their companions, and they took them into Babel, and they stayed in Babylon for a period of 70 years, according to the decree that Jehovah gave through Jeremiah. Daniel talks about this in the famous Daniel chapter 9, of which many prophecy buffs spend many, many years of their life thinking about. At the end of that 70 years, Judah returns. But we still have the northern tribes, the kingdom of Ephraim. Hosea is written to these northern tribes. So I want you to look in chapter 9, in verse 10, beginning in verse 10. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe fruit in the fig tree at her first season. When they came to Baal Peor, this is our focus point today. This is the area that we're focused on in the Torah. When they came to Baal Peor, they dedicated themselves to that shame. And they became detestable like the thing which they loved. As for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them, that there shall not be a man left. Woe also to them when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I saw Tzor, is planted in a pleasant place. But Ephraim shall bring forth his children to the slayer. Give them, O Jehovah, what wilt thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breast. All their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them. For the wickedness of their doings, I will drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. This is very, very strong language about Ephraim. And it's associated with Baal Peor. And notice the mention of Gilgal. From there, all their wickedness is in Gilgal, for there I hated them. For the wickedness of their doings, I drive them out. Now, it's interesting to study what all takes place at Gilgal throughout the history. Remember, from Shittim to Gilgal. So we're talking about a place and events that took place in this area which echo throughout biblical literature into prophetic pronouncements. Verse 16 of Hosea 9, Ephraim is smitten, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit. Yea, though they bring forth, yet will I slay the beloved fruit of their womb. My God will cast him away because they did not hearken to him, and they shall be wonders among the nations, and history has obliged. The northern tribes lost their identity. And there is an association that the prophet Hosea makes that ties this grievous and great sin at Shittim and Gilgal with the ultimate dispersion of the tribes. Very, very interesting that these phrases and names and locales are associated with sins that ultimately lead to the dispersion of the northern kingdom. Now, there is an idea that this particular Torah portion and the story of Pinchas and the tribes and everything that I'm covering today cause me to think about the sins of the fathers. Now remember, Deuteronomy 24:16 says that the sons won't be put to death for the sins of the father and the father of the sons. But listen to me, there is still a requirement to confess the sins of the fathers in order to avert further danger, and it's part of the restoration. So we can't excuse the actions of the fathers. Okay, so you might say, well, I'm not held accountable for the sins of the fathers, so I'll just deal with me. But there is a biblical statement or statements on numerous occasions the Bible tells us basically to confess the sins of the fathers, and some of the things that I'm covering today deal with those sins. And I have to wonder, has anyone ever made it a point to say, let's work on these confessions? Has anyone ever said, hey, look, maybe we should... Now, so what I want to do is I'm going to get into this a little bit, but before I get into the sins of the fathers as it relates to this story, go with me to the book of Leviticus, to the book of Leviticus chapter 26, Leviticus 26, beginning in verse 38. I want to show you the way out, if you will. Leviticus 26, verse 38. This is in that section of text which deals with the consequences, both positive and negative, to one who might adhere or not adhere to the teaching, to the covenant. So beginning in verse 38, Leviticus 26, and you shall perish among the heathen, and the land of your enemies shall consume you or eat you up. And they that are left of you shall pine away in their iniquity in your enemies' lands, and also in the iniquities of their fathers shall they pine away with them. Interesting. And they shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers with their trespass, which they trespassed against me, and that also they've walked contrary to me, and that I also walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies. Then, get this, then only will their uncircumcised hearts be humbled, and then they will make amends for their sins. Then will I remember my covenant with Yaakov, and my covenant with Yitzhak, and my covenant with Abraham will I remember. And I will remember the land. The land also shall be forsaken by them, and shall enjoy her Sabbaths while she lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity, because even because they despised my judgment, and because their soul abhorred my statutes. And yet for all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, nor will I abhor them to destroy them utterly, to break my covenant with them. For I am Jehovah their God, but I will for their sake Remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am Jehovah. These are the statutes and the judgments and the Torah, which Jehovah made between him and the children of Israel on Mount Sinai by the hand of Moses. A couple of things I want you to understand, that these words describe a time in the children of Israel, as Hosea speaks about, will be in the land of its enemies, being consumed, pining away, not only for their sins, but because of the sins of the fathers. That's what put them in this place. But it's not a hopeless place. It's not a helpless condition. Talks about something very interesting, which we've covered over the past several classes, and that is that there has to be a circumcision of the heart. That involves humility, and it involves following the steps of this plan. So again, there are passages which people read and sometimes make themselves to believe that the things that are happening to them are solely the results of their forefathers. And the Bible makes it clear that the punishment that you receive, in other words, there's not a transferent, but there is an association. You're in a certain place because of certain things that took place historically. But a lot of people, I think, ignore this, and this is something which is really standing out in the text for me today, and that is that we must not only make confession of the sins that we have committed, but the iniquity of the fathers. Now, how do you even begin to do that? I mean, some of you are thinking, I've got enough to worry about just in my own life. Okay, well, Psalm 106 is a good place to start. Psalm 106 is almost like a tick. You could put a tick mark. You could take Psalm 106, and by the way, I'm encouraging us to do this, and read through it. And when you read it, make confession of this and say, Jehovah, forgive our fathers for these things. Forgive, 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 forgive. Now, some people may already do this. I don't know. But it just struck me. I wonder if this has ever been placed on a priority list of anyone on their prayer list. All right. So I want you to go with me to Psalm 106. Hopefully this will make sense and it won't confuse and lead people down a wrong thinking, but I think it will tie all together. Go to Psalm 106, and I just want to pick up in verse 28. Now, this is listing the sins of the fathers, by the way, and I'm going to focus on this matter of Baal Peor. Then they joined themselves to Baal Peor. Look, this is a bad, bad event, and it's mentioned throughout Scripture. It's referred to in prophecy and Psalms and Torah and so forth. They joined themselves to Baal Peor and ate the sacrifices of the dead. And the plague broke out upon them. This describes in graphic detail just how bad this was. They joined themselves to Baal Peor and ate sacrifices of the dead. And they provoked him to anger with all these deeds. I mean, they were prostituting themselves, and it's really a gruesome picture. Now look at verse 30. Then stood up Pinchas and executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed. And that was counted to him for righteousness to all generations forevermore. And then it continues with more and more sins. Pinchas, it says, stood up, and the English here says, executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed. Now, we know from the story in the Torah that he takes a spear, if you will, and runs in and stabs through the man and woman who are committing this bad act in the holy place. It's pretty graphic, even in English, but Hebrew, there are some allusions there that are quite graphic. But he stabs them through, and people associate the greatness of Pinchas and his zeal with this act. And that's the way they understood the phrase, and then stood up Pinchas and executed judgment. But you know what the Hebrew says here is interesting. Vayifalel. He stood up. Vayifalel. And he prayed. Now there's a difference, at least as I understand it, between executed judgment and prayed. Now, I'm just going by what the Hebrew says here. Go look it up yourself. You know, people, you can check this out on Blue Letter Bible if you don't have another program, but it's quite good. I mean, you know, look it up. Look this word up that's translated executed judgment. We know from the Torah that Pinchas did more than just stand up and pray. Go back to Numbers chapter 25 and verse 11. Numbers 25, verse 11. In 25:11, it says, let's start in verse 10. And Jehovah said unto Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, in that he was zealous for my sake among them, that I consume not the children of Israel in my jealousy. So Jehovah says to Moses, he's turned away the plague. He was zealous for my sake, and ultimately stopped the plague because Jehovah, in his jealousy, the English says, was going to wipe them all out. In Hebrew, it's the same word. The root word there is kana, and it's translated sometimes as jealousy, sometimes as zealousy. Zealous and jealous. Kana. So I guess what I want to say is that whatever Pinchas is, the same word is used to describe him as is used to describe Jehovah. Both are kana. It's tied to the root kana. Now, I think that passionate is a better word because translators often struggle with what do I do here to put, you know, how do I do it? Do I call it jealousy or do I say zealous or jealous or what do I plug in here? And you'll see different English translations. Some will use jealous, some will use zealous. You know, the story in Numbers chapter 5 where a man, it says in the English, a spirit of jealousy comes on him, and he thinks, you know, that his wife has been with someone else, and he brings her, you know, the story. This is kana. This is kana. Now, I'm not sure if it means a spirit of jealousy, you know, like someone might bind a spirit of jealousy. You know, I bind you, spirit of jealousy, and but it could be sort of a wind of jealous or a wind of, you know, it's like something, you just kind of feel something like, I think she's cheating on me. You know, it's just a blows through kind of thing. But the word there is the same word used to describe Jehovah in this text, kana. I think it's passionate. It's associated, if you look at Brown Driver Briggs or any of these great lexicons, what it does is it says that this word kana is associated with becoming red in the face, like overcome with deep emotion. Like if you're angry and you get real red in the face, or you're, you know, jealous of something. It's like an overcoming is the way that it seems to define, or it seems that's the meaning. Pinchas is Cana. So is Jehovah. In fact, go with me to Exodus 34. Exodus 34 and verse 14. Exodus 34, verse 14. For thou shalt worship no other God, for Jehovah, whose name is Cana, translated here jealous, is a jealous God. Ki Yehovah Cana Shemo El Canahu. Because Jehovah is jealous, his name El Cana is he. His name is Cana. In other words, it's part of the description of his character. Jehovah is very passionate. Let's look at a couple of others that I can think of. Look at Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, verse 5. For I, Jehovah your God, am a jealous God. Kianoki Yehovah Loheka El Cana, because I, Jehovah your God, am an El Cana, a jealous God. Look at Deuteronomy 4:24. Deuteronomy 4:24. Just want to catch a couple of these so you get the point. Deuteronomy 4:24. For Jehovah your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Ki Yehovah Eloheka esh okla hu El Cana. He's a jealous God, a consuming fire. Look at Deuteronomy 5, verse 9. Deuteronomy 5, verse 9. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, Jehovah your God, am a jealous God. In chapter 6, verse 15, just so you have these in your notes. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 15. For Jehovah your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of Jehovah your God be inflamed against thee, and he destroy thee from off the face of the earth. Look, don't forget, Jehovah is an El Cana, zealous, passionate God. He tolerates no association of his people with worshiping another. Now, you might say, I can't tend to think of my God as being jealous, but I want you to make the association of a spouse who is passionate about one they love and they think that they've been with someone else. You know, one of the ways that we get a glimpse of God's character is knowing the way we are created in his image. That feeling that God has when his people have been with another God is comparable on some level, evidently, with a person taking someone else's spouse. That's the image that the Bible wants to give us. So if Jehovah is an El Cana, a passionate El, then so must those be who seek to follow him. Psalm 106 says that Pinchas, or that the actions of Pinchas, driven by this Cana, were counted unto him as righteousness. Now, a lot of times people don't associate righteousness, first of all, as even being something that can be achieved by a person. But it clearly is something which can be achieved by a person, and it's required according to the biblical text. Look, Jehovah's ways are righteous, and we ought to be passionate about serving Jehovah and keeping his ways. Look, let's get a couple of passages in. Go to Psalm 119. Psalm 119, you'll recognize this longest psalm, longest chapter in the Bible, some call it. Psalm 119, beginning in verse 136. Rivers of water run down from my eyes because they do not keep your Torah. Righteous art thou, O Jehovah, and upright are thy judgments. Thou hast commanded thy testimonies in righteousness and in great faithfulness. My zeal consumes me because my enemies have forgotten your words. So according, the psalmist is saying that he's weeping because the people aren't keeping Torah. The righteousness of God, basically, is being spurned and ignored. And so the writer here says that zeal consumes him. People assume this is written by David, but we don't know. It doesn't, I don't think it, let's see, does it say? I can't remember, Psalm 119. No, it doesn't say. So here I am saying the writer, he, we don't know. Could have been a woman. I don't know. Go to Psalm 69. Psalm 69 and verse 10. Psalm 69, verse 10. Many of you know this. For zeal, the zeal of your house has consumed me, and the taunts of those who taunt thee are fallen upon me. Again, here, the writer makes it very clear. David says that zeal, kana, has consumed him. Now, the regular Haftarah associated with Torah reading Pinchas marries up another personality that we know from the biblical text who is also a passionate person. The person to which I refer is one by the name of Eliyahu, Elijah. Elijah, according to the Haftarah associated with the Torah portion, Pinchas. By the way, the rabbis call Elijah Pinchas. They say that Elijah is sort of another manifestation of Pinchas. How literally do they mean this? The point is that they demonstrate very similar traits in that both of them exhibit zeal, kana, zealousness on behalf of God's ways. Remember in 1 Kings 18, there's this great battle where Eliyahu faces the prophets of Baal, and he slays 450 of these prophets. And then word gets back to Jezebel, and Jezebel puts a word on the street that come morning light, I'm going to kill you. You know, I'm going to do to you what you did to these other prophets. And he runs scared and goes to Horeb. Very interesting. That's where he goes. Little getaway. And you remember the story now. He's battling the prophets of Baal. This God continues to show up. And I would posit that this God shows up in modern days in certain ways, possibly that people hadn't recognized, but that's another class. So he flees to Horeb. He goes there, and when he's there, the story is in 1 Kings 19. So if you go with me to 1 Kings 19, I just want to read a couple of verses. 1 Kings 19, he's asked a question by the one that he encounters, and the question is very simple. What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here, Elijah? And he says, if you look at 19 and 10, and he said, I have been very zealous
I have been very zealous for Jehovah, God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and slain your prophets with the sword, and I am left, and they seek my life to take it away. The one to whom he speaks says, go stand in this other place. And again, he is encountered with a question. What are you doing here, Eliyahu? And he said, I've been very zealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and slain your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Kana. Both express kana. We're going to come back to this in a few moments. Now, kana also figures in the story of the famous Maccabees. We know of the book of Maccabees. I have the book of Maccabees here, and I will pick it up and read a passage in a moment. But I have some things in my notes I'll cover first. Mattathias burns with zeal, we read, and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to righteous anger. Later it says, thus he, referring to Mattathias, he burned with zeal for the Torah as Pinchas did. So Pinchas is one who stands out as a zealot. Mattathias cried in a loud voice, saying, let everyone who is zealous for the Torah and supports the covenant come out with me. And his days drew near to die, and he says this to his sons. This is Mattathias. Arrogance and reproach have now become strong. It is a time of ruin and furious anger. Now, my children, show zeal for the Torah and give your lives for the covenant of our fathers. So he's trying to illustrate how bad times have gotten. And he says, you know, it's so out of hand, you have to even be willing to give your life for the covenant. Why was that? Because they were dying. People were being killed for their standing for the covenant. Now, I want to read one passage from the story in Maccabees. This is, again, part of the speech attributed to Mattathias before he dies. He says, remember the deeds of the fathers, which they did in their generations, and received great honor and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful when tested, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness? References to Genesis 15:6. Remember, it said he trusted Jehovah, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Just like Psalm 106 says that what Pinchas did was accounted to him for righteousness. All right. Verse 53 of 1 Maccabees 2. Joseph, in the time of his distress, kept the commandment and became lord of Egypt. Pinchas, our father, because he was deeply zealous, received the covenant of everlasting priesthood. Joshua, because he fulfilled the command, became a judge in Israel. Caleb, because he testified in the assembly, received an inheritance in the land. David, because he was merciful, inherited the throne of the kingdom forever. Elijah, because of great zeal for the Torah, was taken up to heaven. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael believed and were saved from the flame. Daniel, because of his innocence, was delivered from the mouth of lions. And it goes on, so therefore, stand up, basically, for the Torah. Abraham trusted Jehovah, and it was counted unto him as righteousness. Pinchas stood and prayed, exhibited zeal, matching his zeal with the zeal of Jehovah as best he could, aligning himself in kana with the Creator. And it was counted to him for righteousness. Passion for the teaching of a passionate Elohim. An Elkanah is what distinguishes, I believe, the true followers in all ages from the crowd. But more than passion is needed. More than kana is needed. You know, Pinchas is very passionate, and he goes across to talk to the people of Manasseh and Gad and the half tribe of the half tribe of Manasseh. And he goes over, he marches over there with zeal, and he's going to put them to the sword because they built an altar. But that's not what they were doing. He was misguided. He was wrong. He admitted it, but he went over there with zeal, and he realized that in his zeal, he acted in haste. Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, zealous. I am zealous for your Torah and your covenant. They've done this and they've done that, and I alone am left. He thought he was alone, but God told him there are more than 7,000 which haven't bowed to Baal. My point is this. In our zeal, we have to be somewhat reserved and sensitive to the Spirit as well. Because in one's zeal, a lot of people act in zeal. But there's a sensitivity, there's a guidance from the Spirit which must be coupled with that zeal. I'll give you an example. When Moses, in this particular Torah portion, goes to appoint his successor, if zeal is all it took, Pinchas would be the one who brought the children of Israel into the promised land. But he anoints and appoints Joshua to do that task of settling the tribes. And why is that? If you think about the book of Bamidbar, in Numbers chapter 27, verse 15 through 17, let's go ahead and go there because this is important. I've pointed this out in the past. This is actually the final word from Moses to Jehovah. You go, wait a minute, what about Deuteronomy? In Deuteronomy, he's reading the scroll to the people, but in Numbers 27, verse 15, it says, "And Moses spoke to Jehovah, saying, let Jehovah, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and who may go in before them, who may lead them out and may bring them in, that the congregation of Jehovah be not as sheep that have no shepherd." Now, this is right after Jehovah tells him, "You will not go in the land." And his final word to Jehovah was paraphrased, "Okay, then, well, let's make sure that someone is appointed over them to shepherd the people." Because his concern is on behalf of the people which he has guided for 40 years in the wilderness. Now look at the answer. "And Jehovah said to Moses," verse 18, "take thee, Yehoshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is spirit, and lay thy hand upon him and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and give him charge in their sight." One must demonstrate more than zeal. It requires one in whom there is spirit. So the closing points, we're talking about zeal and the roots of righteousness. I would conclude by saying we, as seekers of Jehovah, as those who seek to live according to His ways, we should be passionate. We should be very passionate, be zealous. Kana. We serve an Elkana. We should trust in Jehovah. Both of these are considered righteousness. We should stand and pray, because by standing and praying, Pinchas, in his zeal, was able to quell the storm that was coming against the children of Israel, to stay the plague. But above all, and I think this is the most important, that we should pray to be those in whom the Spirit is. Because zeal is not enough. It requires the Spirit of the living God, which at times demonstrates great zeal. It's also compassionate, loving kindness, and so forth. So think about these things, and we will come back shortly for a, what do you call that? Dialogue. Yeah, we'll be back shortly for a dialogue. Shabbat shalom.